The market doesn't joke around, so why would you? Get serious. Choose Tastytrade. Tastytrade gives you the tools you need to make smarter moves. Dig into data with advanced charting, track profit accurately with order chain trackers, see risk clearly with curve analysis, and trade with low-capped commissions, stocks, options, futures, and more. All on one platform. No wonder serious traders choose Tastytrade. Join the club, genius. Tasty Trading is a registered broker-dealer and member of FINRA and SIPC.
Live from the Nasdaq Market Site in the heart of New York City's Times Square, this is Fast Money. Here's what's on tap tonight. Rally on, stocks closing out a strong quarter with the S&P gaining 10% since the start of the year. It's notched 22 record closes in that time. But as we get ready to kick off the new quarter on Monday, can we expect the momentum to continue? We've got some answers. Plus, the true price of production, a new study finding the cost to manufacture the wildly popular diabetes drug Ozempic. It's far lower than what patients are charged. We dig into the numbers and what it could mean for the future of these treatments. And later, a short call gives MicroStrategy some macro losses. Estee Lauder shares get a makeover and head toward their highs of the year. And the Chartmaster thinks it might be time to buy the banks. He's laying out his case later this hour. I'm Melissa Lee, coming to you live from Studio B at the Nasdaq. On the desk tonight, Tim Seymour, Karen Feinerman, Carter Worth, and Steve Grasso. We begin with the big Q1 kickoff for markets. The S&P surging more than 10%, locking in its best start to a year since 2019. The Dow notching its strongest first quarter since 2021. All three major indices now on five-month winning streaks as well. Nearly all S&P sectors finishing the quarter in the green, with communication services, energy, tech, and financials all up double digits. And it wasn't just equities. Oil, gold, rates, and the dollar all climbing in Q1. So can all or any of these assets keep rising in this new quarter? I mean, it's a little counterintuitive for everything to be going higher at the same time, Tim.
Well, it was risk on, but you had a lot of cross currents because a stronger dollar and higher yield should have been, you know, somewhat negative for equities. You saw a lot of the end of the world. We're worried about policy. We're worried about political upheaval kind of proxy plays, whether that was gold, Bitcoin, uranium, also had big quarters. And it was the first time that the Nasdaq had underperformed the S&P on a quarterly basis. Not by a lot, but it did underperform the S&P for the first time since 4Q22. I mean, it's notable that this was a very strong quarter for stocks. And most people that are market participants actually felt like this was a really exciting quarter because it was banks, it was industrials, it was transports, it was energy, it was healthcare. It was all those sectors that we said coming into the year had a chance to do something. We just didn't know that NVIDIA was also going to do 90%. And you almost would have thought those things happen if NVIDIA doesn't do its 90%, but there was something in it for everybody.
Yeah. Carter, what'd you make of this action?
I mean, the truth, I guess everyone's so happy with the cost of capital, right? Isn't it get down to that? We see what happens when the 10-year goes above 5, people get very unhappy. When it starts to get to 3.80, they're gonna cut 6 times as a recession coming. It turns out that it's a Goldilocks moment for rates, right? We're stuck at this 4.4, 4.3, whatever it might be, and the market continues to expand the multiple, even though the earnings have improved. The question is, how much more can you really expand the multiple at 25 times? I don't suspect a lot more.
Mm-hmm. Do you think we could?
Well, their earnings could grow more
yes,
than it
yes, right.
That is a possibility as well, right? And I don't know whether the somewhat hot inflationary data is indicative of that likelihood,
right,
or that it becomes more difficult. Mm-hmm. I would sort of, he looks like he really wants to say something.
Oh, I can. Well, one thing, I mean, it's not just tech, and you were talking about that. I mean, think about two stocks that have nothing to do with anything AI, Caterpillar and American Express. They're both up 60% from their October low. The S&P is up 29%, meaning it has broadened out, but that also is the problem. 60% advance for American Express and Caterpillar in 5 months, are they not full, rich?
So what else?
Although,
exactly.
You know, we know the pendulum swing
too far.
Right. So I sort of think we're more in the fair value-ish range on a lot of things, particularly as we've broadened out relatively recently, mm-hmm, right? We've still seen, I mean, the IWM has had a nice little run here, but is still so far below the S&P, so far below a lot of other things. So I think the broadening is good.
Grasso, what do you think? Because you can make the case, one could make the case that if the Fed cuts rates, it's good for the markets. If the Fed keeps rates pat, that's also good for the markets.
Yeah, and I believe I'm in the first camp that I think the Fed is going to cut rates more than we think. So I think that's going to help the market. So if the dollar goes down, that's going to help markets go up. That's going to help Bitcoin go up. That's going to help gold go up. That's going to help oil go up. if earnings really start increasing, to Karen's point, I think you're going to see the overall market increase. And I think people have not really factored in how strong the rate cuts are going to be. I think everyone got on the wrong side of the boat. Everyone got with the data. Everyone is starting to get was starting to get a little bit too hawkish. But the key is you can't see the cracks in the economy in order to start cutting. Then it's too late. You have to do it before. So I think they're actually behind probably the cutting cycle by about, I don't know, 4 months or so. So I think they should have been cutting already. I think it's going to be a little bit of momentum going into year end. Not so crazy. So when Carter said, are they full? I think we could see 5,500 in the S&P.
But you actually argued, Tim, and you made this point last night, that if the Fed stands pat, that's actually the best thing for the markets, that the economy is pretty good and we're holding up. We don't need rate cuts.
Can we define something? Standing pat, where does that come from? I mean, is that just a poker thing?
That's something that you standing pat look into during the commercial.
I'm going to come back to that information because I know everybody at home has been thinking the same thing. I do think that a Fed that does nothing, and I think the Fed borders on doing more of nothing than doing a lot, or I certainly pray for that. I think it's a dynamic that means that the economy is stronger, that we've seen some resilience. We've certainly seen certain parts of the economy do very well. We've dissected where the consumer may be kind of on the leading edge. But what's fascinating about this quarter, and Carter's as good of a guy to talk about certain sectors and leadership and where you've had laggards. But if you had told me, I know there's that game, that Apple, Tesla, Nike and Lululemon were going to all be down more than 10% in the first quarter, I would have said, sounds like discretionary is falling apart. Sounds like the labor market's falling apart. Sounds like the consumer is really dying here. And in fact, that's not what happened.
Right. I mean, the other things have moved to the fore, right? So housing continues to be strong, or the autos. And so it's this sort of movable feast. And yet somehow, of course, we are in this, and there's no way around this, right? We are this steep, uncorrected, almost 6 month advance with the aggregate up 30 and stocks like American Express and Caterpillar up 60, both trading right now higher than where analysts that cover those stocks, 40, 50 analysts each, think the stocks will be 12 months ahead.
That's funny mentals.
I get it. No, but that's but you guys do that. You do all funny mentals.
I'm
trying to fit in.
And AXP. I mean, for CAT and AXP specifically, do those charts look very vulnerable?
Yes.
You're making the case that these are charts that advance too much and they will fall apart, and therefore they will
fall apart. Not necessarily that word, but I mean, does one commit new capital to an old line, mature, not even growth companies, right? These are cyclical companies that are up 60% in 5 months, trading at price levels that are higher than Wall Street's 12-month price target. I would say no.
Okay, well, I would maybe make the case they shouldn't have been trading where they were before.
Before. Okay, forget before.
Right.
But here and now.
But here and now.
We buy them or sell them?
CAT probably sell, AXP maybe closer to a buy. I don't know.
Okay.
But those were the two that you said?
Yeah.
Because they both happen to be double the S&P from the same period.
But just what you said, would you put new money? Is there always new money coming into the market, though? That has to be somewhere, right?
Always.
There's so where does it has to go somewhere.
Well, let me take the side of the fundamentalists. What do we call fundamentalists?
Yeah. Please.
Is that GM was trading south of 4x earnings before it went on a 73% move from that inflection point at the end of October. Citibank was trading at 0.045 price to tangible book value before it went on a 63 or 64% move. By the way, both really outperforming peers in their relative groups, saying that there was something wrong. Now, as a guy that's been long GM for a long time, I've been wrong a long time on good old Global Motors. But there is a dynamic where I think you get back to price. And I think we also, we see this with airlines. We needed the economy to really normalize. It's one thing to in 21 and 22 to talk about normalization, but now we've really normalized. And I think there are some places left to do that.
All right. Our next guest is interested in stocks that benefit from rate cuts. Tony Dwyer is the chief market strategist at Canaccord Genuity. It's great to see you here on set, Tony.
It's great to be here, Mel. It's great to see you guys.
So here's the first question, though. Rate cuts happen in a backdrop of the economy weakening? Or is it because, I mean, what happens in
So it is weakening in the employment data. And I think something that one of the most aggressive topics that I talk to clients about is how bad the incoming data is. So I'm going to take you a little bit in the weeds here. There's something called the initiation survey rate. It's when I reach out to you and say, how many people do you fire? How many people do you hire? I'm the BLS, you're the company. before the pandemic, 70% of the companies would get back to the Bureau of Labor Statistics and say, we laid off this many people or we hired this many people. Last in January, it was 27%. So we're getting employment data. We got 167,000 job negative revision in the last payroll employment report. And it's not that they're manipulating the data. The conspiracy theorists go bananas with this stuff. It's really that they don't have a good collection mechanism. So the revisions are significant, and most of them have been negative, Mel. Mm-hmm. So I think that some of the Lululemon, some of the consumer hits that have happened, if you looked at Lululemon a month ago, it's up and to the right.
Yeah.
It's parabolic. It's like everything else. And if you look at the Russell 2000 a week ago last Wednesday, it's down for the year. So I think it's just a little bit of perspective on the economy slowing and what it might mean for rates and the consumer.
So what benefits in that environment where the economy is weakening and we do have rate cuts?
Well, our focus now is those rate cuts are what you need. You need to kill the zombie. Right. And the zombie is an economy that you're waiting for it because of the inversion of the yield curve and the higher interest rates to slow down enough to go into recession. Until something happens with the Fed and lower rates, it's going to be very hard to disprove that you can eventually go into a recession because you normally have. Our view is that the vast all of the earnings growth from 2023 was the Mag 7. According to our earnings wizard, LSEG, it literally was a negative number for earnings growth last year, ex the Mag 7. It's same for this quarter. It'd be a negative number. As we go into the end of the year and into next year, it's much more even. So that's where we're calling for the broadening of the market. It's coming from a broadening of the earnings growth participation. It's not just the Mag 7. So if you get lower inflation and lower interest rates and start to get scared about the unemployment rate going up, that sets the stage for that real early cycle recovery we could get in those areas that benefit from lower rates.
So what if you get a little lower employment, but really not a lot of relief on the cuts? Let's say you get one. Does that change your outlook?
It would. Where I'll be wrong is if rates stay here or actually go up. I find it very hard to believe that that's going to happen, Kara. Like, if you think about when rates were going up, it was the end of the higher inflation where they did four rate hikes of 75 basis points in a clip to slow it down. The trajectory of the core PCE, which we get tomorrow, is exactly the opposite right now. So if it goes down a little bit more and it stays on this trajectory, you get a continued move up in the unemployment rate. You get a continued move down in the inflation rate. Karen, I can't imagine they're going to go 25 basis points after going from zero to 550. They're going to go, 25 is enough. We're good.
Zero. So zero, that's
Yeah. So call it two to five. We're that 5.25 is the upper end. Maybe it comes to four. That's enough to really kickstart. That happens with weaker employment. That happens with weaker spending. And that's it. I'm not saying they have to go back to zero, but they have to be more aggressive to reinvert in whatever they do to get the curve back to normal.
So we've gone from higher for longer, right? That was the mantra. And of course, the exact opposite happened. Rates dropped from 5 to 3.8. Then at 3.8, consensus was there'll be 6 cuts, 7 cuts. That's all off the table. Now it's 1, maybe none. What if there is, just as you're implying, nothing? They just stay pat and don't stand pat.
It was a political term back in 1896, referring to patents, but it's still a poker term. We should keep moving.
Remember, they were only going to do 3 hikes.
Right, 3 hikes. So 3 hikes
and then 3 cuts.
But let's say they actually just somehow keep juggling the ball and do nothing. Do you think that is Goldilocks or that's a problem?
I think that creates a bigger recession.
Bigger recession problem. Yep.
I think the Fed needs to get, I'm kind of on Steve's camp, the Fed needs to get aggressive here. Remember, when inflation was moving up and spiking like it's moving down now, they were telling us they were only going to do 3 hikes. We're good after 3 hikes. That's the peak rate. Not so much. So if you get weaker employment, the whole picture here for the economy is we're at full employment. Manufacturing has been in a recession for the better part of 2 years. Non-res construction's turning over. So
really quick, because I know we don't have a lot of time left, but I heard you say zombie refer to our economy in zombie terms. And yet we also have a dynamic also out there for markets where financial conditions are out of control.
Out of control without Fed movement.
None of this seems to make sense. And yet you think the Fed hasn't moved fast enough. And I think they lit the market on fire last week.
Oh, they absolutely lit the market on fire by staying with remember, they revised the growth and inflation up, but stayed with 3 cuts. He also said we're at the peak of the cycle in terms of rates. that was not gray. So I'm not saying that we go into a service-based recession and the market collapses. There is no history I can find with this kind of momentum that calls for market collapse. At this point, when you're this overbought and this extreme to the upside, you just want to wait for a better opportunity. In our view, that comes with this worsening employment data that cuts rates. You worry about the economy. That's when I want to go in, not levered long at, right, you know, after the kind of rates that we've been or the kind of move in stocks we've been talking about.
Tony, thanks. Good to see you.
It's great to see all of you.
Great to have
the TD here.
Steve, he agrees with you in terms of the cuts?
Yeah, so I think they're going to cut. Probably, most likely, they'll surprise everyone and cut in May. They'll go in July and they'll go in September. They'll skip those months in between, and I think that'll catch the market, and that'll light a fire underneath the market. And it doesn't matter. November is a moot point. November, the meeting is right at the election date, so that's out. Forget about that one. So, and you don't know how much they're going to cut at each meeting. So you're going to have that extra push from money coming in from money markets going back into the equity markets, because forget about valuation. People are going to start to chase. We've seen meme stocks. That's what happens.
You think they go 50 at a meeting?
I think it's possible that they can go 50 at a meeting, yes. And I think it's possible that they cut more than anyone thought. As Carter said, they went from 7 to 3, but we don't know how much they're actually going to cut in those 3.
All right. By the way, we are off for Good Friday tomorrow, but be sure to tune in to CNBC.com for live coverage of the key PCE inflation data. We'll be online with full coverage starting at 8:15 a.m. Morgan Brennan, Steve Leisman, Rick Santelli will bring you the numbers, the news, the analysis, 8:15 a.m. tomorrow on CNBC.com. Meantime, Tesla shares taking another hit today after Deutsche Bank cut its forecast for Q1 vehicle production. Analysts now looking for about 414,000 units produced, down from 427 before, as demand from China weakened in March. Tesla stock is down nearly 30% year to date. The forecast cut comes after Morgan Stanley's Adam Jonas lowered his delivery estimate by about 9% just yesterday. Tesla expected to report its Q1 numbers early next week. We've actually had a drumbeat of analysts reducing those forecasts going into this number next week.
You know, with all due respect, there's been a bit of a herd mentality in terms of the analyst community on this, and at times, you know, right in both directions. So it's interesting. It's the growth company with the growth multiple that maybe isn't growing. It's the company that, to play offense, decided to cut margins, cut prices, and be more aggressive, and yet, you know, we're not sure. And so it gets back to multiple for me. It gets back to, you know, I just think, again, if you look over the last 2.5 years, you know, GM to Tesla, it's actually a pretty fair trade. And we all know that Tesla's, some of the drivers for Tesla as a stock were technical things on some level. I mean, they really were. It was S&P inclusion. It was splits. Obviously, this company is so far ahead of their peers in EV, but we've had this kind of global, all right, we got that first round of EV buyers out of the way. We all know, by the way, GM had interesting EV numbers yesterday that rallied the stock. So let's be clear, EV is still very much something to be thinking about. But yeah, Tesla, you know, down 26% Q1.
Steve, are you doubting Tesla at this point?
I think Tesla's had a lot thrown at them, but they also have a lot of levers that they can pull as well. And you know, when you look at what's happened to them, look at what's happened to the other EV car makers. Look at what's happened to Fisker. Look at what's happened to Lucid. Look at what's you know, happened to Rivian to a large extent. But it's just basically right now your options for buying an EV are Tesla and Rivian. So, yes, and I know there's the Chinese EV makers as well, but let's just talk about those. Tesla's still head and shoulders above everybody in the EV world. The problem is if the American car makers pivot and go hybrid like Toyota, that's a problem for Tesla.
I mean, the assumption, though, is that these competitors go away and that the demand is still as strong. But if the demand also goes away, then that's still a problem for Tesla. Where's the chart at this point?
I mean, there's so many ways. One could say, listen, if a stock can go from 11 to 400, it must be doing something right. But that same stock also lost 75% of its value, and right now is the same price it was 3 years ago. It's the nature of momentum, right? You're on the right side of momentum or in the wrong side. Here now, it's the easy maybe thing to say, but it's a pair of twos. Why do it? Why be long? Why be short? Sometimes your best trades are the ones you never do.
All All right, coming up, Sam Bankman jailed. The FTX founder sentenced to 25 years in prison for his role in the crypto exchange's downfall. We'll take a closer look at what the prosecutor called one of the largest financial frauds in history. That's next. Plus, Discount Healthcare will dive into the technicals on Johnson & Johnson, learn why one of our traders says there's value hiding this name. All that and much more right after this.
This is Fast Money with Melissa Lee. Right here on CNBC.
You seek the key, but first, you must learn the ways of precision, craft, and performance with Acura's all-electric ZDX. With a premium Bang & Olufsen sound system, up to a 313-mile range, and a Type S variant with an estimated 500 horsepower, the ZDX is their most powerful SUV yet. Unlock the energy when you visit Acura.com to order yours today.
What does it mean to be rich? Maybe it's less about reaching a magic number and more about discovering the magic in life. At Edward Jones, our dedicated financial advisors are the people you can count on for financial strategies that help support a life you love. Because the key to being rich is knowing what counts. Learn more about our comprehensive approach to planning at edwardjones.com/findyourrich. Edward Jones, member SIPC.
Welcome back to Fast Money. FTX founder Sam Bankman-Fried sentenced to 25 years today for the securities fraud conspiracy that brought down his crypto exchange. The court also ordering him to forfeit $11 billion to help repay victims. Let's bring in Kate Rooney for the details. Kate, historic verdict here.
Yeah, it was, Melissa. That sentence caps off what U.S. prosecutors say was one of the biggest financial frauds in U.S. history. Today, Sam Bankman-Fried took the stand. He was in a beige prison jumpsuit, pleading for the judge's leniency with a much more contrite, apologetic tone than what we heard when he was cross-examined back in the fall during his criminal trial. He said his actions, quote, haunt him every day. The judge admonished the 32-year-old, pointed to the enormous harm he did, the brazenness of his actions, his exceptional flexibility, as the judge put it, with the truth, and his apparent lack of any real remorse. Also said he committed perjury on the stand, which played into the sentencing. Bankman-Fried was found guilty in November on 7 counts of fraud and conspiracy. His defense team does plan to appeal, and a lot of the sentencing today talked about customer losses. That was key. The larger the losses, often the longer the sentence. The defense had tried to argue that the losses were zero, since much of it will eventually be recouped based on how the bankruptcy process is going. The judge didn't buy that, though. Used the analogy of a thief who then went to Vegas and then gambled what he stole. If he got it back, it doesn't negate the crime. And that was a key moment. Customers could eventually get the dollar value of their accounts back. That was at the time FTX collapsed, but they're not going to get their cryptocurrency, meaning some may have missed out on Bitcoin's 300% rise since then, Mel. Back to you.
Kate, thank you. Kate Rooney, who's been covering this trial since the very beginning. But to think about this as the biggest financial fraud in history, we've had remarkable
ones.
We sure have. And to think that this one was the biggest is
Well, some of the things that always characterize a fraud or kind of a go-go period where there's not a whole lot of due diligence involved. There's a lot of clubby investing that went on here, and there were some people that didn't do their work. But I think it was also a period of really extraordinary, kind of risk on, and a place certainly in crypto and digital land where a lot of people, I think, were very careless about who they invested in. The fact is that this was a guy that really, part of this sentence, it almost sounds like someone that showed zero remorse. And that's part of it.
Biggest fraud, but very short term. The real big one was the guy, because you never want to promise too much. Keep it going. Madoff kept them going for decades. That's a whole different game.
Yeah. Let's stick with crypto here. Shares of MicroStrategy tumbling more than 11% today after Carisdale Capital issued a short call on the company. Analysts saying the stock's premium is, quote unquote, unjustifiable and that things have gotten carried away. Analysts, though, are long on Bitcoin. MicroStrategy is still up 170% this year, even with today's sell-off. It hit its highest level since 2000 just yesterday. We've talked about this in the context of MicroStrategy since the Bitcoin ETFs have been released, and that is, why would you want to buy MicroStrategy and also buy the software business, even if it's geared towards Bitcoin now, why do you want to buy that instead of just Bitcoin itself when that's such an easy bet now?
Right. Well, that is the whole basis of the short call.
Yeah.
It's really this, you know, if you want to make the bet, make the direct bet and see if those two things collapse. We saw it in GBTC, which was just a terrible instrument, but the only one you could really do. And so for a long time, it traded at a premium until, of course, it traded at a discount. Why couldn't that happen here? And you're hedged because you have the other side. You can do that now.
Yeah. Steve, you agree with this sort of call?
Yeah. I mean, I like the way they broke out the tech from the relationship and the ratio to the underlying asset that it goes up. They made a good case for it. And yes, it should come back in. But once again, markets can remain irrational. And people have a cult feel for this stock. There's people who won't sell it no matter how much you try to convince them that they should sell it. But they are, to your point, hedging it with an ETF. That's where I am. I'm still in IBIT, and I think that's a much better play. IBIT or Robinhood, because you get a different dimension with a Robinhood than you do with a micro.
There's a lot more Fast Money to come. Here's what's coming up next.
Could Johnson & Johnson go higher and higher? One of our traders thinks the name could be among the best values in the healthcare space. We'll test the technicals on this one next. Plus, the diabetes drug Disconnect. A new study says patients could be paying more than 200 times what it costs to make Ozempic. Inside the pricing dichotomy and what it means for the future of the GLP-1 space. You're watching Fast Money, live from the NASDAQ market site in Times Square. We're back right after this.
What's on the horizon for financial markets? At PGIM, it's a question that over 1,400 investment professionals relentlessly research in pursuit of your long-term goals. Specialized across asset classes, but united in collaboration, our teams provide global and local expertise. Our investments shape tomorrow, today. Pursue your tomorrow with PGIM, a leading global asset manager.
Welcome back to Fast Money. Some news on Johnson & Johnson catching your eye this week. First reports that the healthcare giant is in talks to buy medical device maker Shockwave. And then yesterday, news that the company can contest evidence linking its talcum powder to cancer. Shares of J&J up slightly since Monday, but they've really been treading water over the past 3 years. But Tim bought some this week. So what'd you see, Tim?
So let me clarify. First of all, I'm long the stock. I have clients that are long the stock. I bought calls. Through their earnings, which are out April 16th. And the news yesterday is just a reason. It's almost like it kind of shocked you to attention, like, oh, this stock hasn't moved in 3 years. It's three companies in one. It's a conglomerate that I think there's a lot of intrinsic value. This overhang related to their the litigation attached to the talc exposure, it's a horrific dynamic that's happened where they are linked and their talc was at least linked, and that's the allegation, to ovarian cancer. A federal judge said yesterday, we'll give you another chance to fight that. Whether that's, you know, where the stock is going to get its next move from, I don't even know that that's the case. I think they have a number of different dynamics in terms of their pharma pipeline. I think there's some dynamics even on the medical device side. I just think that J&J, you know, it's not an apples to apples comparison, but if you think about how dead GE was, and again, the ability to unlock value in these various companies, I think J&J has some work to do. And I think they have some work to do in terms of cost cutting. And I just think this is an asset that is worth taking a shot on. It's something I was already long. And I think they have some good news up their sleeve.
Would you make the comparison to GE?
Well, I think that's right. I mean, but usually as a technique, you wait for it to turn. Mm-hmm. To your point, it's been treading water, right? You said 3.5 years. In fact, it's the exact same price it was in January of 2021. I think you have no downside risk. So the question is, do you just get stuck in the muddle? It just keeps doing what it's been doing. Or does it...
Did you say stuck in the muddle?
Yes. Yeah, you mean you're muddling? You know,
okay. No, I...
But here, look on the screen here. Look at that. So that looks like an EKG chart when you go to the doctor. Right? That's just going up and down and up and down, with going nowhere. That's a three-year. The one thing that is getting almost hysterical, final chart, look at J&J's relative performance to the healthcare sector.
Yeah. Yeah.
It is at an all-time 35-year low. I mean, this was Johnny John. It was the biggest, most prominent American healthcare business that you could have. It will turn at some point. So I think you have asymmetry. little downside and unknown, but perspective, lots of upside.
Oh, that sounds like a very good verdict.
I think so.
I like stories like that.
And Carter never says hysterical. It's just not in his
not his vocabulary.
Yeah.
Does this attract you?
Not this one in particular, though. I do have one of the two X's in my helm trade, which is the XLV,
right,
which is obviously it's an ETF, and I think Eli Lilly is the largest holding of that. But I have a number of positions in the whole space. It's not that I dislike that one. It actually, it's more intriguing now. If I'd love to be in something that has no downside or relatively no downside.
Usually you're not allowed to say that.
Right. Or, and some potentially decent upside. Worth a look.
Coming up, a new study says diabetes drug Ozempic can be manufactured for less than $5 a month. So why is it costing patients so much more than that? We'll sit down with one of the authors behind this blockbuster paper. That's next. Plus, a glamorous trade upgrade for Estee Lauder. This beauty stock having a beautiful day after a bullish note from Bank of America. Why the makeup name is making one of our traders blush right after this.
Missed a moment of Fast? Catch us anytime on the go. Follow the Fast Money Podcast. We're back right after this.
Welcome back to Fast Money. The Dow and S&P setting fresh record closes to end the quarter, while the Nasdaq closed the day just about flat. But there were a lot of stocks making some big moves in the session. Walgreens Boots jumping more than 3% after the company reported a revenue beat. Still, the pharmacy chain did narrow its full year guidance. And Home Depot shares sinking after inking a deal to buy specialty distributor SRS for more than $18 billion, a move to grow its professional sales business. And a look at some meme stock madness to end the quarter. Reddit and Trump Media both dropping after several big up days. AMC also lower, that company announcing plans to sell $250 million worth of stock at the market. Karen, you've been watching this.
I've been fascinated by this whole thing. And then I see a headline like this. Oh, I wonder where the debt's trading. So I take a look at the debt. It was actually trading much better than I thought. Any stock they can sell at any price is good for the debt, for sure. But the idea that it could even approach where, I mean, you know, getting back to fully paid off is...
You mean like when it was peak meme?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That, or that they could just find liquidity somehow and he keeps, you know, Adam Aaron, I don't know how he does it. I didn't realize they were still able to sell stock. Are they authorized? If somebody knows, please tell me. If they're authorized to sell additional shares, they must be, or they wouldn't have done this. But I thought that was the whole ape thing and the conversion from preferreds into, Anyway, interesting in meme land.
Meantime, a new study finds Novo Nordisk's blockbuster diabetes drug Ozempic can be manufactured for under $5 for a month's supply compared to near $1,000 out-of-pocket list price in the U.S. Referencing the findings in a tweet yesterday, Senator Bernie Sanders wrote, quote, "There is no rational reason other than greed for Novo Nordisk to charge Americans nearly $1,000 a month for Ozempic." The senator telling Bloomberg today that he wants to meet with Novo's CEO to discuss lowering prices as early as next week. Joining us now is one of the authors of the study, Melissa Barber, postdoctoral fellow at Yale University. Melissa, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Is the senator's conclusion, is that the conclusion that you wanted people to walk away with when they read the study?
I don't know that I came in with a normative intention, right? I'm a health economist. I'm trying to put information into the public sphere that comes with evidence and is transparent in my process and allows people to then make decisions from that. So I'm not sure I'll have a strong opinion on what I wanted the study to do, if that makes sense.
Right. I understand. In terms of how you came up with that $5 a month figure, I just want to understand that more and help our viewers understand that more. You factor in a lot of different things like the active ingredient cost per unit, cost to formulate, and other expenses, the profit. You do include a profit margin for the company. When you calculate active ingredient cost, how do you come up with that number in terms of how you manufacture semaglutide, and what sort of molecule are you basing that number on?
Sure. So where possible, I rely on real-world costs rather than modeling. So in order to understand how much it costs semaglutide to manufacture, I use real-world trade data. So every day, when medicines are made, they're made both as kind of key starting ingredients, active pharmaceutical ingredient, and the finished product. And every day companies are trading raw materials on global markets. And you can read data on this and you can analyze it. So I look at basically semaglutide transactions between firms for how much they're buying and selling raw ingredients. And then I also interview manufacturers to kind of have a gut check to make sure that it's in line with their experience.
Since semaglutide is a patented molecule, though, how do you get that exact information? Are you using Novo Nordisk's costs for these active ingredients, or are you using other metrics? Because you can produce semaglutide, which could be a sodium-based semaglutide or an acetate-based semaglutide, and I'm wondering if you're using that as a comparison number, which would not be entirely fair.
No, I'm not using that as a comparison number. It's not that I have access to Novo Nordisk's costs, but when companies are buying and selling product across borders, they have to make certain declarations on the value of the product. So I take advantage of that in terms of trade data. This is quite a standard data source. There's quite a lot of publications in the economics literature. Enber works with this sort of data. So this is quite a standard source for these sorts of questions.
In terms of a shortfall of the study, what do you think that might be? What do you think the biggest shortfall could be? Because I would think that there's nothing in, I mean, you have mentioned a profit margin, but there's not sort of a recouping of the cost of research and development that Novo Nordisk has done over the years in order to actually come up with semaglutide.
Sure. That's a really important point. I guess it's a question of, is it a limitation of the study or what was my research question? So I'm not trying to say, what does it cost Novo Nordisk today to manufacture the drug? I'm saying using quite reasonable assumptions based on the trade literature and cost inputs from manufacturers, what is a kind of a reasonable range with which we might expect Novo Nordisk or, importantly, another company that might license the intellectual property from Novo Nordisk to be able to manufacture it themselves, what would those costs be? So in terms of limitations around I'm not accounting for innovation, yes, that's true. And I hope that someone comes out with a study estimating the cost of developing semaglutide by Novo Nordisk, but that's not what the study was about. These are kind of two separate questions.
Okay. In terms of the $5 versus $1,000, and this is specifically, we should point out once again, for the diabetes drug Ozempic, do you think that that gap should be closed?
I think that people should be able to afford their medicine that need it. So, yeah. I mean, there is a fair price somewhere between the price that it costs to manufacture a drug and a price that captures these kinds of innovation questions that you're asking, right? And there are other models, right? Right now we have a model where high prices are supposed to pay for innovation, but there are other models, right? We have prize funds for antibiotics. There's all sorts of nascent policy experimentation for how we might pay for innovation in different ways. But given the model we have, we also have to think about cost in different places, right? So this study I conducted with Médecins Sans Frontières, MSF, and they carry out operations in a lot of low-income countries and humanitarian contexts. So the question is, should MSF's humanitarian operations, are they the right body to be paying for, you know, a huge, huge profit margin to recoup the cost of innovation? No, like people, the right price is a price that people can afford.
All right. Melissa, thanks so much for joining us. We appreciate it. Fascinating study. Melissa Barber of Yale University. But again, this thrusts these companies into the spotlight once again for that very populist and popular notion of, you know, pharma companies gouging consumers.
Well, first of all, that was a fascinating discussion, and you did your part in that, too. What's also interesting is that she's done hundreds of studies on drugs since 2016 using the similar algo. And you know, there's patents. There's a lot of different dynamics to think about. But there may be some opportunity to kind of look and see at what point other drugs that were this far ahead of their peers and had the ability to price wherever they wanted and at what point there was a price breakage. We know patent windows have everything to do with that, but there also may be other dynamics that did change the backdrop.
Well, some other dynamics which seem really obvious is that other competitors,
yes,
competing drugs, come onto the scene and just force price to be lower for this drug.
Well, that was a really interesting Melissa conversation there, but I think
it was
to your point about, all right, how much did they put into this, which she, you know, says, all right, that's not included in the study.
Right.
That wasn't the point of her study. What is the right return on that? Because you also have to include in any company like this, they're going to have some misses as well, right? So you need some additional return. And what's the denominator? Yeah. Is it 10 years worth of that should be earned back over 5 years, 10 years? I don't know.
And shouldn't that be a patent, right? The reason why companies
have that patent protection
a drug is put on the Medicare Part D list, in which case it could be subject to negotiation. So
But if I'm not incented to strike gold, I'm not going to go do the work. I mean, think of some of the times we've had needs in this country to actually come up with a cure. And we've had, I mean, it's exciting when it happens, and people are excited for that.
All right. Coming up, a beautiful buy in the makeup space. Analysts giving Estee Lauder some contour confidence. So can it be a highlight for your portfolio? We will flex into Tim's Blycep trade. It's the E, by the way, in Blycep. To get his thoughts, Fast Money's back in two. Welcome back to Fast Money. Shares of Estee Lauder topping the tape today and popping more than 6% after an upgrade from Bank of America. Analysts now rating the stock a buy, raising their price target to 170 from 160. The firm citing a range of initiatives to recover profitability, sharpen brand efficacy, and achieve more balance across channels and geographies. EL is the E, of course, in Tim's Blycep trade.
I love how I stole the L from Lyft, and it was not part of my original acronym. I just
allowed it to happen.
It's very, like, it's a very fair team. It's a very fair team. So the news and the headline is also that they are now going to be in the Amazon premium beauty, essentially storefront online, that Clinique will join that, and there are other EL brands to follow. We forget, or maybe other people don't know this, is that they have four of the top five skin brands in the United States. So it's not as if this isn't a giant company who has suffered in two places. They've suffered in China and they've suffered in travel retail, which has also been slumping. These are the two places that are going to be really the key. Have we bottomed there? And have we started to see a lot of that inventory overhang in China change places? But it's a case where if you look at the upgrades from the street, so get into the models, get into the valuation. Most people had them making $2 to $3 a share in 24, which means actually this was a very expensive stock. Now they're starting to push this up. It could be $7 a share. Maybe that makes it 20 times instead of 50.
Coming up, the S&P insurance sector could be hitting its top, according to the Chartmaster. He will share where else he's finding opportunities. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Fast Money. The S&P Insurance Index has been on a tear over the past year, soaring almost 36%. The Chartmaster thinks it might be hitting its top, and investors could find comfort elsewhere. Let's get to the Chartmaster, worth charting, of course. So what are the details here?
Yeah, so just looking within the financial sector, you have one area that's steep and uncorrected. It's a fairly low beta area, and it's largely tied to rates, but insurance stocks have gone through the roof. You can see here on the screen. So this is an index that has Travelers and Allstate and Progressive and Chubb and Aflac and AIG, big names, but far, far above trend. By contradistinction, look at the BKX index, of course, which we know has been in a downtrend, and you'll see that on the next chart, and it's starting to bottom. It's been bottoming for about 6 months. So what if we juxtapose those two, one to another? Third chart. This is a comparative chart over 5 years. They track quite closely, and of course, they've diverged over the past 9-10 months. At this point, our thinking is that you reduce exposure to insurers, and you increase exposures to banks in general. Mm-hmm. So one way to do that is look at a ratio chart. We'll do three in a row. So this is one thing divided by another. It gives you a relative strength line. It's insurance divided by BKX. And what you see here is it's starting to roll over, right? This is a little bit of an issue. And so our thinking is, again, you want to be underweight insurance. Let's look at the next iteration. Not only is the 150-day turning, but you have a head and shoulders. Final iteration, you're breaking trend. The general thesis here is within the financial sector, start to go underweight insurers and overweight banks.
Steve, do you like banks here?
Yeah, I do. And it's surprising when you look at the charts because you kind of forget about the banks. They seem boring and in the background. Obviously, regionals have had their issues, but the large money center banks have really been outperforming. And when you start to see rates peak and rates start to come in, it actually favors, it's a tailwind to banks because they're going to have a ton more loans, a lot more equity loans putting out. So it probably benefits both insurance companies and banks, but the way Carter mapped it out as far as the relationship between the two, your bigger bang for your buck is probably going to be the financial, so I agree.
Karen?
Well, I like the big banks,
yes.
Right? And I do think so. I mean, one of the underpinnings of insurance is rates. They have this float, the higher rates. I think that the banks have more flexibility, and the lower rates hit the float more heavily. Banks can sort of navigate that better. So I like JP Morgan, my favorite.
Up next, final trades.
programming note, do not miss live coverage tomorrow of the PCE inflation report. Be live on CNBC.com starting at 8:15 a.m. Eastern to bring you the numbers, the news, and analysis. Time for the final trade. Steve Grasso.
My Bitcoin ETF, iBit. I think Bitcoin's on its path to 100,000. This one's going to go with it.
Karen.
Wow, I'm sort of thrown by that. Yeah. off of related to Tim's Estee Lauder from Blicep is Ulta, which I think is cheaper and directionally the same thing.
It's the E in the Blicep. Carter.
As opposed to most insurers, we've extended Lincoln National, a $5 billion mid-cap name that's just now bottoming out.
Tim Seymour.
Happy Easter to those celebrating. And Pfizer, Tim's Pfizer.
I got to say happy birthday to my kids.
Get there.
I'm sorry. Thank you. Happy birthday, Jack and Lucy. Oh, my God, that would have been terrible. Okay.
I'm out.
Proceed.
All right. Happy birthday, Jack and Lucy. Mad Money starts right now.
All opinions expressed by the Fast Money participants are solely their opinions and do not reflect the opinions of CNBC, NBC Universal, their parent company or affiliates, and may have been previously disseminated by them on television, radio, internet, or another medium. You should not treat any opinion expressed on this podcast as a specific inducement to make a particular investment or follow a particular strategy, but only as an expression of an opinion. Such opinions are based upon information the Fast Money participants consider reliable, but neither CNBC nor its affiliates and or subsidiaries warrant its completeness or accuracy, and it should not be relied upon as such. To view the full Fast Money disclaimer, please visit cnbc.com/Fast Money Disclaimer.
At Capella University, you'll get support from people who care about your success. From before you enroll to after you graduate, pursue your goals knowing help is available when you need it. Imagine your future differently at capella.edu.